Welcome to Meta Podcast. Today's host is me, Lucia. In episode 178, I extend a warm welcome to today's guest, Aleksandra Milinkovic, who is doing her doctorate at the Faculty of Social Sciences in Ljubljana. Hi, Aleksandra. How are you?
Hi, Lucia. I'm good.
So to start, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
So I come originally from Yugoslavia, but as we know, Yugoslavia doesn't exist anymore. So I was born in Tuzla, which is in Bosnia and Herzegovina. I experienced refugee status in the 92 when the war started. And since then, I've been pretty much migrating all over the world. I finished my BA in Iceland and I did my MA here in Ljubljana. My BA was in political science as well as my MA here at the Faculty of Social Sciences.
Okay, so that's quite a journey you've had, actually. So Iceland, an interesting country, I guess. How did you actually decide to pursue a doctorate, and why here? Why Slovenia?
I'm passionate about teaching. I've been passionate about teaching for a long time, and I knew I wanted to do a PhD when I started my BA in Iceland. I just didn't know when exactly that was going to happen. I was planning to apply at the University of Melbourne, but because of Corona restrictions at the time, they didn't have the master program with research that I was planning to apply. And they suggested that I seek a master degree elsewhere, which I did. And I stumbled upon this program here at the Faculty of Social Sciences in Political Theory. And the program offers extensive preparation, theoretical preparation for the PhD. So that was the reason why I signed up for a master here.
So you actually always knew that you're going to do a PhD?
I don't think I always knew. I think I was like maybe 25 when I started like thinking about doing a PhD. I don't know. I don't think it's something that I knew when I was 3 years old, like people who say that they study medicine, you know, like I knew at five that I wanted to be a doctor.
Okay. So yeah, you didn't know that early, but still like, you know, 25, still pretty early. But also like most of the people that we talk to usually just say, you know, there was an opportunity that presented itself and we just, you know, took it. So, it's still a bit different for you to say, I wanted to do a PhD and I did it, right?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us more about your research? What do you do actually?
So at the moment, I'm doing just a literature review, and that's quite extensive because the subject of my PhD is politics of care and freedom. David Graeber's Politics of Care and Freedom. And
if I can interrupt, who is David Graeber for us that aren't, you know, very into politics and social sciences?
Yeah, so he was an academic and anthropologist. Unfortunately, he passed away 3.5 years ago. My goal for this research is basically to kind of research his work. And in the course of researching his work, I am also planning to apply some of the methodology and theoretical concepts that he developed. So far, I'm just dealing with his work and also a work of other people which is complementary to his work on the same topic.
So he proposed some specific methodologies for his work. And what are those?
So his methodology is a little bit different. So in all of his work, in his opus, he is challenging the dominant discourses. Mm-hmm. To put it in a more simple language, we live in a certain society that is guided by norms and rules. And in his work, he is questioning the society that we live in and the norms and rules that guide it. So he's asking his readers or the consumers of his work to kind of stop down and question the society that we live in and also the position that we hold within the society. What is our role in this society? And how do we define not just our position, but how do we define ourselves in relation to other members of our society? So these are important questions because he was not only an academic, he was also an anarchist, and he practiced anarchism, not just theoretically writing about the anarchism, but he was also practicing it. And one of the brilliant things that when we read Graeber is that most of the books that he wrote are very much accessible to the population, to the people who are not in academia or who might be in academia, but they are not studying either humanities or social sciences, because he was writing his work in a very accessible language and a language that everyone can understand. Mm-hmm. And he was also himself a subject of research in his work. He very often talks about his own experiences with certain things in the society and the world he lived in.
That's really interesting, actually, and really good that, you know, as you've said, he talks about his research in such a way that it's easier to understand, right? That's a really important thing, like, you know, for all scientists to know how to communicate our work properly, right? Tell me more about, like, this, what kind of a world we live in, and what did Graeber and other people think is, like, wrong with it or something? Explain.
So if we start from a premise that we live in a society, like I said, that is constructed on some norms. In my proposal for the thesis and what I'm going to be researching, like you said in our previous conversations, mm-hmm. what I actually say in the first sentence is that we live in patriarchal, white supremacist, but fundamentally class society, bound mm-hmm. by oppressive institutional state structures. So I've said a lot of fancy words there.
You can explain further, of course.
Yeah, of course. So what that means is that our societies are hierarchically structured. And most of the decisions that are made on the top of the hierarchy. And they are implemented from the top of the hierarchy to the bottom. Mm-hmm. And Graeber is actually challenging his readers to question this structure of our society. Mm-hmm. He's asking us not to question just the way we function every day, but one of the most important aspects of his work is to question the educational system and how this knowledge is imposed on us. Because we talk about the power structures in society. So how are these norms implemented and how are they constructed and who has the power to tell us what is right and what is wrong and how do we come to these conclusions? So when one simple example that you would take is day-to-day activities that you do without questioning why you do it. For example, why you stand at the traffic spot, the traffic light when it's red. Like, mm-hmm. who has decided that this is how traffic lights should operate? Like, that's one simple example. So, and then, you know, you can go deeper, of course. I'm just trying to communicate it in a more understandable way.
Of course, it's great that you're trying to, you know, make it understandable. So also, like, of course, I've looked up Graeber. Of course I did. So yeah, like one of the things that I've read about it is that also what he says about like our basic concepts about like production and consumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says that production is nurturing, also cleaning mm-hmm. and stuff. So can you tell me a bit more about that?
So yes, because my topic is politics of care and freedom, what does politics of care mean actually? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about care, what is the first association that comes to mind? It could be someone taking care, like a nurse taking care of a patient in a hospital, mm-hmm. A mother taking care of a child, mm-hmm. A grandmother cooking a meal for a whole family on Sunday afternoon. These are the moments of care that are present in our everyday life. Mm-hmm. But because we live in a patriarchal society, that means it is not gender equal society. Most of the burden of this care falls on women. And this care is often unaccounted and unpaid work, which means that this is a work that is done day-to-day basis. It is not acknowledged a lot of the times, and mm-hmm. it's not even considered. So when we talk about care, we need to, this is where feminism comes into play. And Gräber was, of course, also a feminist because he spoke of these things, of the inequality that exists in our societies of genders. So we need to understand this from a feminist perspective. We live, for example, today in a neoliberal capitalist society. And neoliberalism is not just an economic system. It is a system that organizes life. Mm-hmm. And how neoliberalism organizes life is something that hasn't been, or capitalism in general, how has organized life for hundreds of years, hasn't been something that has been spoken about in dominant academic circles, especially post-1989. So these are the things that we consider. Like in my PhD, I'm taking two theoretical strands and I'm trying to understand these two theoretical components of his work. And I'm trying to expand it through feminist theory, most notably the Marxist feminist theory.
Okay, and what is the Marxist feminist theory?
Well, the Marxist feminist theory technically applies Marxism as a theoretical approach to the issues of inequality regarding women. So when we think about it, one example of this is how do we organize care of children, for example? Mm-hmm. I was born in Yugoslavia. In Yugoslavia, we had daycare, which was subsidized. It was a state-funded daycare. Mm-hmm. And every parent had a right to sign their child to this daycare, which was either subsidized or paid fully by the state. Today, we live in a society that has transformed. And although we have state, like in Slovenia, for example, you have free education, or in Serbia, we have free education, but that education is not often free. State provides, for example, salary for the teachers or for the kindergarten teachers. But all the extra material or extracurricular activities need to be supplemented by the parents. So today we have this like sort of jumbled up system where it's very difficult to access certain welfare state provided opportunities, and thus we have this proliferation, for example, in education of especially in Serbia, I'm not sure for Slovenia, we have private schools, private kindergartens, private universities. And this, of course, is creating a system of inequality, because those who can afford to pay for an education for their children and provide quote unquote better education, but private education doesn't necessarily mean
better
education. Yeah. So this is like, I'm just giving one example, something that everyone can relate to, especially those who are parents and who might be struggling because they are coming from a lower class strata, that is a working class, or they are maybe even precarious class, which is, you know, the class that doesn't really have, works on limited contracts. You don't really have any security. You have to pay for your own health care and social care and so on.
Understood. I guess we have to talk about feminism like a bit more in depth.
Mm-hmm.
So because you've said previously that, you know, care is mostly done by women. Mm-hmm. So we need to talk about, you know, like the housework that is still mostly done by women. And I think it's very important to talk about that housework is still work. So can you like expand a bit on that?
So when we talk about housework, one important aspect that we need to include is class.
Mm-hmm.
So I come from, you know, a poor background, working class. So who does this unpaid housework for whom and in which situations? That means those who have greater privilege and belong to upper stratum in the society, that is a higher class, or, you know, in French terms, bourgeoisie, they have the opportunity to sort of, the women in that class, they have means to provide, to pay someone else to do this housework for them.
Mm-hmm.
And very often, when we speak about the society, let's say in Europe in general, especially in the Western European states, a lot of this work falls on the shoulders of the immigrant women and minority, racial and ethnic minority women. This, for example, for the Balkan region, if we are talking, for example, for Serbia, this might look very different, let's say, for ethnically white Serbian than it would look for Roma woman, mm-hmm. who, depending where she lives and how she lives, what kind of housework and care work she needs to do as well, because this is the racial and class stratification that exists in Serbian society. It's very different from, for example, French society, because they have a lot of minorities there, and they are actually the one who are supplementing, who are used for this care work. And for women in general, because we live in the society where we live, and here comes, you know, this questioning of the position that we're in, what is our position in the way the society is structured. It is challenging for a lot of people, because those who live in a position of privilege often don't want to give in to this criticism, precisely because they will lose this position.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about feminism in particular, this has to do with cis white men who are in the position of power, and they have been for a position of power. And in the moments when we are challenging this position of power in the hierarchical structure, that's when we have these reactionary tendencies. So we have this manosphere groups, right-wing politics rising, and so on. So in these situations, key is education and emancipation. But how actually we do this? That is the real question. How do you educate and emancipate not only women, but also men and minority groups to challenge these structures and create something, a more egalitarian society that is more equal society.
Yes. And how do you think we can do that?
So one simple example is that we, when we say politics, people often think about this big state politics, diplomacy, I don't know, relations between different states and so on. But our daily lives are also political. And what I'm saying is that private is also political. And it's much more difficult to challenge the inequalities that are present in our everyday life than it is to challenge the politicians who are in position of power. So how do we challenge our own siblings, our own parents, our partners who might be in a position of power in our household? And these are very, sometimes very uncomfortable conversations that people need to have. But in order to have them, you need to apply something that is called democratic deliberation. And in order to understand what democratic deliberation is, it's basically a conversation where you sit down and we deliberate what we don't like within our household. Like, how are the chores, house chores distributed between the house members? So that's a starting point for me, because we need to go back to this sort of like micro level. When we think about change and implementing change, often we become so overwhelmed because we are thinking of these big global changes that need to be implemented. My hypothesis in that aspect is that we need to start first from our closest circle, and then we sort of expand that slowly and slowly.
That's, I mean, I agree with everything you've said. It starts at home. First and foremost, it starts at home. And I think I'm gonna, you know, take your advice and talk about this at home, I guess.
But another aspect of this is, when we are talking about challenging those who are closest to us about these the unequal system that we live in, we also need to examine the dominating structures of how our society is formed. So our society is formed first from the smallest nucleus, that is a family. And how is a family defined? It's usually a heterosexual couple who has children, possibly two.
1.5.
Yeah.
1.5 children.
A boy and a girl, you know, yeah. And it sort of, you know, expands. So we need to challenge the way we structure also our society in those forms, because how do we define a family as well? Is it based on biological determinants, like who are our biological parents? These are the things, you know, these are also the questions. And then we need to also challenge certain institutions and how they implement their work and so on and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of work. We have a lot of work to do.
Yes.
A long way to go, I think.
Yeah.
Another thing that, like, blew my mind is when you sent me your PhD thesis, right? Like, there was this a sentence there that was, you know, it was something in the line of, you know, housework is just like slavery, is the backbone of the capitalist machine.
Yes.
It blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, this is like so true. And I was like, you know, louder for the people in the back. Like, housework is just like slavery.
I do and have to point out, this is not something that I coined myself. This repeated by many brilliant feminists several decades ago, and they are still repeating it today, those who are alive, of course.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's something that we need to talk about. And then another thing, like I've Googled stuff, of course I did. And it says that the contribution of housework is $10.8 trillion to the global economy.
Yeah.
And of course, I Googled and I was like, you know, what's the assets of the largest bank in the world?
Mm.
And I found out that the largest bank in the world is in China. Industrial and Commercial Bank of China has $6.1 trillion in assets. So still less than the housework we do. Yeah. I mean, this is amazing. This is just, we need to talk about this. Again, blew my mind. Like, we've talked about feminism a lot. So would you say that you're a feminist?
Yes.
Definitely. Yes.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, of course. Also, I have to ask, like, how do you see the women in our society? Are we equal? And how do you see it here in Slovenia? How do you see it, I don't know, in Iceland? You've been there. How do you see it in your home country?
So, I mean, when you think about the position of women, let's say, I don't know, 200 years ago in this region here in the Balkans, for Slovenia, who was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and for Serbia, who was part of the Ottoman Empire, it was very different from what we have today. And we need to acknowledge that certain steps have been made to improve the position of women. However, at the same time, although women are included in the workforce, they might be financially more independent, now we are going again back to this housework. They are still the main caretakers in the family. Mm-hmm. And this is something that obviously needs to change. And talking of Iceland obviously has some policies that has helped, kind of like progressive policies that have helped sort of foster this change in the society. But I think one of the things about the Icelandic society, which stands out in comparison, let's say, to Serbian or Slovenian society, is the fact that for them, their cultural norms were quite different, and the way their society was structured before the implementation of these policies in the last few decades has actually allowed for it to be implemented much easier, and for the people in society to accept it as something that is incredibly important. Of course, that doesn't mean that Icelandic society is by any means this perfect feminist utopia where, you know, women can just relax and, you know, men take equal share of whatever, like work in the home and care work in general. So, of course, this is not, but we see some differences. However, what I kind of disagree here, and this is where Gräber comes into play, is that still these policies are implemented top down.
Mm-hmm.
So the states and the institutions that represent state are implementing these policies. And very often you might have some law that is voted on, and you might have some law that is like beneficial, but how is this law implemented and whether it is having any significant change? That is a very different question, you know, that we also need to address. In this context, let's say maternity leave in Iceland, it's split between the two partners, a man and a woman, if we're talking about heterosexual couples. So a woman gets 3 months mandatory maternity leave, a man gets 3 months mandatory maternity leave, and the other 3 months are either split between them, or one partner takes it, it just depends. Like it's a matter of how they work it out amongst themselves. But what often happens is that these 3 months, where they can decide what they're going to do, we can guess who actually
of
takes
course.
The 3 months of
the women.
So of course, and this is where what we lack in our societies is community care. We don't have community care beyond, let's say, the nucleus of the family. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't expand. Also, because we live in neoliberal society, capitalist society, this sort of asking someone for some assistance has become significantly difficult because of various obstacles. We don't want to inconvenience anyone. We don't want to make a fuss. We don't want to seem like we are struggling. We want to keep on these perceptions that the society says that's how a perfect mother, father should function. But we know that in reality, it doesn't work. And that's where Gräber's theory and practice of anarchism comes into play. So how do we practice this care through creation of communal care, where we have a system that is devised in such a way where we are there for each other, not just, you know, having some close related friends that we can call 3 a.m. in the morning when we're having, I don't know, some trouble, we have to go to the hospital or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's why he's challenging these state structures. And that's why I also believe that we need to challenge them, because the societies, in his work, most particularly, The Dawn of Everything, that he co-wrote with David Wengrow, he's challenging this idea that this is how societies have existed for thousands and thousands of years, because this is also a myth. And we need to understand that societies have existed in different structures and different forms in different parts of the world. And the most recent structure that we have is the one that exists for the last, let's say, I don't know, a couple of hundred years. It wasn't always like this. And that's something that is omitted during our education.
I think we've talked a lot about why your research is important, but could you just, you know, say it in a few short sentences?
My research is important because I firmly believe that the way our society works today, the way we function, it's not something that can continue. So we obviously need to change a lot of things. And this is part of David Gräber's work. It's that all of these theoretical concepts that I have spoken of, this can be implemented practically. Mm-hmm. One example is, how do we resist these forms of oppression? Mm-hmm. So again, we need to turn to history and look at how resistance was created. So when I say resistance, the first association would be probably something like with a gun taking and, you know, rebellion or something like that. But resistance has taken many forms and has existed for thousands of years. And the resistance is actually the root and the backbone of recreating more egalitarian societies. So when I say resistance could be something that is just so simple. Resist in your home not to do dishes. If you're the one who's doing most of the time the dishes, that's also a form of resistance, you know? It's actually more hard than you think. Like,
I know. Yeah. I will make a shirt. I will make a t-shirt. Resist doing the dishes.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Here we go. Okay. Any recommendations for books, games, movies, websites, or podcasts?
I have actually prepared a list of books. So the one book that I will definitely recommend if anybody is interested to get into David Gräber's work, And that is the book called The Bullshit Jobs. And that is written, like I said, in a language that is easily accessible to everyone and everyone can understand and also relate to the topic of the book. And the second book I'm going to recommend is going to be by Françoise Berger. She has two books, A Feminist Theory of Violence and A Decolonial Feminism. So there.
Ideal dinner guest, no restrictions.
No restrictions. I have six.
Give me two.
Okay, two. Now, because of the genocide that is being committed currently in Gaza, my two choices would be Hassan Kanafani and Kwame Ture.
Okay, an explanation for those?
Hassan Kanafani was a revolutionary, a Palestinian revolutionary who was also an author. He was a poet and a writer. Highly recommend also his books. Mm-hmm. And Kwame Ture was a Black American member of the Black Panther Party who was mm-hmm. An excellent Marxist. And anyone who Googles him or looks on YouTube, they will find a lot of his lectures. And he has a really, really good rhetoric and he speaks very understandably. He's brilliant. He's one of my favorite Marxist theoreticians.
Suggestions for improving doctoral studies or any updates?
I would like to challenge the way the standardized higher education works. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is how university has become this factory of knowledge, where knowledge is just reproduced. Mm-hmm. There is very little of new knowledge that is coming out. And in that regard, I would like to recommend another book, which is called Dark Academia, How Universities Die by Peter Fleming. And he talks about this and many other things regarding universities.
Any coping mechanisms for stress and uncertainty that comes during a PhD?
I really don't have a solution for that. I think the solution is resistance. Resistance and organizing.
One piece of advice for future PhD students.
Anything goes. Challenge, challenge, challenge. Try new things.
And
try
resist.
To push as much as you can. I know that we are a lot of the times in a position where we can't do this. But when you can, organize your colleagues. Try to create a more egalitarian connections and egalitarian work environment in your universities.
Alexandra, thank you so much for this interview today. For me personally, it was mind-blowing and eye-opening, and I have a few t-shirts to prepare apparently for printing.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I had a blast talking to you. It was a lot of fun. And I hope that maybe someone will be motivated by our conversation. And
read the books.
Yeah, read the books or just, you know, watch some YouTube lectures. They are also available, or seek out additional material. Yeah.
Thanks again and have a nice day.
You too.
Poslušali ste Meta podcast, v katerem se pogovarjamo z mladimi znanstveniki in znanstvenicami z različnih področij znanosti. Podcast domuje na spletišču metinalista.si, kjer najdete tudi druge zanimive znanstvene vsebine. Naše delo lahko podprete z donacijo Metini listi. Pohvale, pripombe in predloge lahko posredujete po e-mailu znanost@metinalista.si. Dobrodošli so tudi komentarji na Facebook profilu Metine liste in na Twitterju @metinalista, kjer uporabite hashtag metapodcast.
Ustvarjanje podcasta in popularizacijo znanosti podpira Javna agencija za znanstveno, raziskovalno in inovacijsko dejavnost Republike Slovenije.
Se slišimo čez 14 dni.